The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
We are joined in studio now by two very eminent people. One, we're used to his eminence. It's Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at the School of Immunology at Trinity College in Dublin. We're also joined by Peter Openshaw, who is Professor of Experimental Medicine at Imperial College London and Vice Chair of NERVTAG, the UK's new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group. And that is indeed a mouthful. Good morning and welcome to you both. Now, Luke, you're here on Friday because you're in the throes of a big international conference at Trinity.
Yeah, that's right. For the last 2 days, we've been getting, we're COVIDized out of the world. Yeah. All these speakers have come to Dublin to speak about COVID and the whole story from start to finish, really. It's fantastic. We've got loads of international speakers here as well. And tomorrow, actually, the public can come. So the public are welcome to join us in Trinity tomorrow for a public day. Again, we're going to discuss all the usual issues. So it's been a great couple of days, really.
Okay, now, if you can bring us through some of the themes that your speakers were sharing.
Sure, but it's everything from where it's started, where did it come from, the whole history of the pandemic, you know, and then the triumph of the vaccines. We had two spectacular talks on the history.
Have you guys decided then, was it the lab or the market?
Oh God, we still don't know, shockingly. That's still the unknown, sadly, you know, but it's a bat anyway, and it could be some intermediate species, so we're all agreed on that. You still can't say if it was from the wild, shall we say, or in a lab. Yeah. The jury's still out on that, you know.
Okay, so that's the origin of it, and then right. I presume the variations on the COVID-19 theme.
All the variants coming along. I mean, if you want to get a history of this virus, sit in, you know, it's amazing. And then the triumph of the vaccines. So Adrian Hill from Oxford gave a fantastic talk on the AstraZeneca vaccine, the whole history of it, really insightful account. That vaccine has saved hundreds of millions of lives, remember, never forget that. And it got kicked, as you will remember. Yeah. Very effective vaccine, and Adrian gave the whole story. A great talk, that was a guy called Aaron Siegel from Israel. Now, I'd been reporting on Aaron's stuff all through the pandemic, and he tweeted at one point, the magic has begun. Israel was the first country to vaccinate, and we began to see the efficacy in the over 65.
They were using Pfizer, were they not?
They were.
And they had a deal with Pfizer that they would share their data with Pfizer in order to prove or potentially disprove the efficacy of that.
And Aaron was the key guy. He was the key advisor to the Israeli government. He was doing deals, as it were, with the likes of Pfizer. So he was really in the heat of it. And to have him here in Dublin was great to hear him speak, you know. And that tweet he sent out, the magic has begun, I think you and I would have even mentioned that. He said that got like 100 million likes, you know, and it was in the New York Times. Because again, Israel was the first place to show the vaccine was working in the field. Our fear was the trials are one thing. Until it's out in the field, you don't know. And there was this huge efficacy with the vaccine for the over 60s, which was tremendous.
Now, we spent a lot of time during the years of the pandemic stressing that the vaccines, they didn't stop it necessarily, but they stopped you going to hospital.
They did.
They stopped you getting seriously ill. That message was sometimes lost.
Lost, and that was very clear now. There was a guy called Alex Setti who's from California. Now, he is the world expert on T cells and COVID. Again, you and I would have spoken about T cells a lot. And it's very clear the vaccines don't stop infection. That's very clear now. But they do stop you progressing into severe disease. And he loads of data to support that. And Kingston Mills, my great colleague, he's got data similarly. So the vaccines, sadly, don't stop infection, but they do stop you getting really sick. Now, that meant the discussion moves on to the next-gen vaccines, which we hope will stop infection. That's the real goal. And there's several in development now that should stop you getting infected as well as stopping progression.
Because in the early days when we saw the scenes of temporary morgues outside the hospitals in Italy and we're wondering what lies ahead for us and what changed all that were the vaccines.
Very simple. Very simple. And if anybody who denies vaccines, come to this conference, because speaker after speaker, data after data, it's just so overwhelming. Independent confirmation, which us scientists love. So that's right. The vaccine saved us.
You guys are all in a conspiracy together. You know, you've got chips provided by Bill Gates through your bloodstream. I mean, that's what's going on there. You're all one of a kind.
You've got to stop going down those rabbit holes, pal. You'll never come back up out of them. You might get myxomatosis if you don't watch it.
All right. So Peter, your talk at the conference covered what?
So we're starting out to describe the way in which we collaborated. You know, there was a wonderful opportunity for collaboration between different labs, looking at different aspects of the virus and the host, trying to work out, you know, what contribution there was to severe sickness from, you know, variations in the virus or different host genetics. And that brought together people who've been researching many, many different areas, really. In a big collaborative study, we recruited over half of all the UK hospitalizations to this study. And it's been an enormous resource in terms of all the immunology that we can do. But also all the medical insights into diseases that we hitherto haven't very well understood.
Have you come to any conclusion as to why some people get very sick and other people do not?
Well, there's a big signal from the host genetics. So there's probably over 30 different genes that make you more or less susceptible to severe disease. So it's what we call polygenic. You know, it's not a simple one or two gene. It's a combination of all these different genes. But the main determinant has been age and also things like obesity and social deprivation. You know, all of those factors are very, very clear now. And they're slightly different from the factors that cause severe illness in influenza, which we previously studied extensively.
Yeah. Now, the question of genetics, I mean, everyone has a unique genome, but, you know, family members have similar, you know, with their variations. If one person doesn't get it, are the rest of them probably okay?
Well, there's a lot of interesting work going on trying to understand why it is that you can actually, say, share a bed with somebody who's got COVID and you don't get it. So, you know, what determines that that difference is so interesting. And it is, again, down to the innate immune system, largely.
You know, I mean, for example, you've got spouses who have lived together for a number of years and one gets it and the other does not.
Yeah.
But before they met, I mean, they've had a history of their immune system very different to each other. You know, my father, he used to say that he never got sick because as a child, he used to swim in the canal and there'd be a sack with a dead dog in it, you know, floating up beside him. And he figured his immune system was tough. Yeah. It didn't save him in the end, but at the same time, he always maintained he had a robust immune system.
Yes. So we've been doing human challenge studies on volunteers with several viruses. We did influenza a few years ago, and before that we were doing a virus called respiratory syncytial virus, which causes wheezy colds in babies.
How do you persuade people to allow themselves to be infected by these?
Well, it's surprising how keen people are to volunteer. I think there's a number of different motivations. We do pay them. We don't pay them handsomely. We are not allowed to pay them handsomely. But obviously the payment is something which gets people interested. A lot of them, once they become involved in the study, are actually really interested in the science. They get very interested in what it is that you're doing, why you're taking samples and what you're showing. And some of them actually are determined to do this because they know that animal research has its limits in terms of being able to tell you about human disease. And they're quite committed to supporting human research because it gives you unique insights that you just can't quite get from the animals.
And in terms of those viruses that you have studied with human volunteers, what have you learned?
Well, going back to what we were saying before, if we take a group of volunteers and we give them all the virus directly into the nose, usually about roughly half of them become infected, the other half don't. So this allows us to do what we call prospective studies, where you can take samples out of the nose, take blood samples and, you know, establish a pattern of responses which are associated with that protection.
Because there may be someone who's infected in the nose and whose immune system battles it in the nose. It gets no further.
It gets no further.
Others,
exactly.
It might be further down where the battle occurs, and others will succumb in the lungs.
Absolutely right. I mean, so what the vaccines do is stop it going down into the lungs, but don't necessarily prime the nose in the way that allows defense at that first encounter. Mm. So what we need are these new vaccines, which are mucosal vaccines, which prime the lining of the nose and which stop the virus actually replicating and passing on to somebody else.
Now, I don't know enough about human biology to know about the interconnectedness between the nose and the throat. But if someone is someone who's jogging and they tend to through their mouth all the time and the virus goes in that way, mm-hmm. what then?
Yes. Well, that is one way in which you can acquire virus lower down is by inhaling secretions from your own nose and throat. But if you do have a lot of circulating antibody induced by, say, a vaccine which is given into the muscle, then that will actually stop the virus from going down into the lung because there is a sort of bit of leakiness out into the lung of the circulating antibody.
But for the most part of the population, the non-jogging part, a little sniff of something up the nose, vaccine up the nose, might prevent a huge amount of infection.
It might. It might well. And there might also be ways of stimulating the lining of the nose using nasal sprays that might make the nose less receptive in general to viruses. You know, I don't think we're there yet, but there are products which you can get in the chemist which claim to do this. I think those can be vastly improved.
Now, both of you are involved in Horizon, Beyond the Horizon research. Luke, you're in the new group established by the government, and you're, as I said, a vice chair of NervTag. It's a great name, isn't it?
I think it has a resonance to it, yep.
It does. It stands for the Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group, so it's very good. New and emerging, new, that gives us the N. Luke, how far have you got so far with the group in Ireland?
Well, it's interesting now, Pat. Yeah, we had our first meeting about 2 weeks ago. Big round table, Tony Houlihan in the chair. And of course, you see all these people and you've seen them on the TV, haven't you? That's the strange thing. Ronan Glynn was there, you know. Mary Horgan, a great bunch of people, I have to say. Four immunologists, very importantly, Clean O'Farrelly and more, you know. We had John Wenger, a ventilation expert from UCC. So it's a great group of people, you see. The first meeting was just a meet and the agenda, absolute, what's going to happen in the autumn is question number one that we're all addressing at the moment.
Whether we're still coping with a COVID variant or, you know, as we've talked about before, Luke, how seasonal is it? Yep. Is it to do with weather? Is it to do with behaviour patterns, eating outdoors, recreating outdoors and all of that?
Well, the minister who came in yesterday, Stephen Donnelly, joined us yesterday for this round table, and his first question was, is there a spike starting now? Because as you've seen, there's an uptick in hospitalisations at the moment. Over the past 10 days, there's a slight trend towards increased cases in hospital.
Many of them are incidentally discovered.
They
go to hospital, they're tested. Oh, you have COVID.
Yep.
Didn't know. I came in with a broken leg.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it seems it's in the hospital as they're catching it. You know, it's not this morning, Pat. Tony Houlihan issued a report saying they might be picking it up in the hospital. So that's interesting anyway. You know? But the question is, are we at the start of a spike? Now, the good thing is, if there is increased infection, the vaccines will protect against severe disease. But the big question is, come September, October, will we see a big spike? Because we're back indoors again, and this spreads indoors. And what do we do about that? So the CAG, as it's called, the COVID Advisory Group, is very much planning for what's going to happen in the autumn, really. It's likely there will be another vaccination campaign, a fourth or a fifth shot. It could be one of the newer vaccines, because Moderna just published yesterday, they've got an Omicron-specific vaccine. They gave a massive response in the trial. And again, it's clinical trials, so we watch closely what might happen.
But because there were debates about how effective vaccines would be against Omicron, particularly the later variants. But now Moderna have a precisely tailored one.
They have, and they're claiming an eightfold improvement on their previous vaccine based on measuring antibodies and so on. And that's a one-liner in the press release. We'd like to see the data. But still, if that's true, that Moderna vaccine could be the one that we'll use in the autumn. Now, again, NIAC, it's the job of NIAC to advise on this. So they'll be looking at all this data to see what the Irish, and not just Ireland, the UK is the same, you know, what will a vaccination campaign look like in the autumn? Should there be an increase in cases again? And of course, the key numbers, ICU admissions, that's right.
This is probably not part of your discussions at the conference, but I'm just wondering, have the people who are vaccine hesitant, any of them changed their minds? Because by their lights, the people who were scaremongering about the vaccine, we should all be dropping like flies.
Yes, and you'd hope they would have changed. I mean, 11 billion people doses have been given up out of these vaccines, and the safety signal is superb, you see. So there's no reason not to take the vaccine at all now, you see. Now, again, some people will never take a vaccine no matter what you do, you see, and that's their choice. That's fine. It's their decision.
Now, Peter, looking beyond the visible horizon to what might lie ahead, I mean, how do you go about that work? I mean, are you looking at animal populations? The latest thing we've been talking about on this program is monkeypox and how unusual this cluster of monkeypox cases is. But it seems it's nothing particular to worry about. But do you look at animal populations or for the next virus?
Yes, many of these viruses are coming from an animal reservoir somewhere. And as we put more pressure on the animal world through intrusion into their natural habitats, we're going to see more and more viruses coming from animals. I mean, I think this monkeypox is something to worry about. I would be, you know, I think it's really worth trying to get rid of it if it's possible. But it looks like there's so many cases in so many different countries now. Maybe it is becoming uncontrollable. And what we're hoping is that it won't mostly present as a very severe disease. But, I do think this is a concern, but it's an example of one of the many viruses that's come out of animal reservoirs.
I mean, Luke's been telling us that if we're of a certain age and we've had a smallpox vaccination, we are probably somewhat protected.
Somewhat, but I think you need to be boosted with the smallpox vaccine repeatedly if you're going to be protected against multiple other pox viruses. I mean, I do think this is a bit of a concern. And if it were to get into populations, say, in primary schools, children are more susceptible that could be more of a problem. So I think it is a public health concern, and we do need to find cases, notify them, and try and prevent
spread. I mean, if we look at COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, and we think, you know, we know where it came from, we're not quite sure market or lab, but so what? It came from Wuhan in China, and we can understand it was in bats and so on. The monkey one started in monkeys, but it does exist in populations in Africa. It is kind of a straw in the wind, isn't it, about what may lie ahead with other infections?
I mean, there is a sort of inevitable march about the evolution of viruses. You know, they will find a new niche, and then when they find that niche, they will grow to fill it. And that's what we're seeing in this case with the monkeypox. So it seems to have adapted, and it's got a big complex genetic makeup, and it can switch on genes and switch off genes and adapt without necessarily developing genetic mutations. They're very intricate viruses, these pox viruses.
So the lesson to all of us is just leave everything alone. Don't go into jungles and rainforests and start despoiling them, because there are viruses in there hostile to us, and the, you know, don't give them a chance to escape.
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because the livelihood of people on the margins depends on being able to exploit the local resources, which will include, you know, rainforest and so on.
Some of the comments coming in: I had COVID 3 months ago. I got tinnitus 1 month after I, in quotes, recovered. Could you ask if this was covered at the conference? Will this tinnitus go away? Have you heard of tinnitus, Luke, as a side effect of...
Yeah, Peter's a clinician as well, remember, so Peter would come across these things more than me, but I think tinnitus is one thing, and certainly you see strange sensory changes with this virus. The taste is the big one, and smell, obviously, but I believe there are reports, aren't there, Peter, of things like tinnitus?
Yeah, so in our infection studies with coronavirus, where we infected volunteers, we had a very high rate of loss of sense of smell. And that may have been partly because we gave it as nose drops. But there are so many different symptoms. I mean, just this morning at the conference, Trish Greenhalg, who's a GP, gave a beautiful description of all the multiple ways that long COVID can present. And certainly tinnitus would be amongst them. Yeah. It's very protean.
I'll ask you this one, Peter. COVID and no smell or taste 8 months after Delta. Any resolution?
That's a very long time. I mean, normally we say that it should resolve, and in our volunteers, everyone's loss of sense of smell resolved within a couple of months, fortunately. I mean, if you're still not able to smell at 8 months, you know, maybe it's not going to quite come back, but there are ways that you can retrain your sense of smell. So it is worth trying to get into a specialist.
Lots of people just asking both of you to give your prediction for the autumn.
Lies
ahead. Are we back to masks? Are we back to isolation? Are we back to lockdown?
Well, when the minister went round the table, Pat, with these four world experts, and asked them all that very question, and guess what they all said? We don't really know. It's just sad. And I mean, if you're a scientist, you've got to be honest. You know, there are unknowns here. Now, but we're smart enough to predict what might happen and try to prepare for that. You could have a situation in the autumn, masks will be re-recommended. I think that's a possibility, especially if we see a big spike. And if ICU admissions go up, that makes sense. Masks back on trains and public transports. It's not that big an ask of people, is it? So that's one thing that might come back. The big focus was on the vaccine campaign and therapeutics. But we spent a lot of time talking about antivirals, and this is one of Peter's areas of expertise. Peter was involved in Tamiflu, which was used for flu. So there's a big chat, are they going to work? Are they as good as they say? Can Ireland buy sufficient supplies? That's it's all still being discussed, basically. So it's very much in the discussion phase.
So we'll go back to Donald Rumsfeld and his known unknowns, that's and it. Then the unknown unknowns. And this is one of them, what autumn is going to be like.
Yeah.
Thank you both very much for joining us. Our regular guest, Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at the School of Immunology at Trinity College in Dublin, and Peter Openshaw, Professor of Experimental Medicine at Imperial College London and Vice Chair of NERVTAG, the UK's new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group. Thank you both.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.